Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or what you send to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I have a great announcement I've been working on for a few weeks now and finally can announce this is my product launch. On my channel, I have been known to wear shirts that have these messages that I've created. And, you know, a few of the shirts that I made early on when I started this channel or got going on it, I literally went to Hobby Lobby and I got some letters and some shirts and I just ironed them on and I just made some shirts, you know, Got Logic and, you know, I Find Your Lack of Logic Disturbing and, I don't know, some other one, Reason, Use It or Lose It, you know, and I've had some other ideas since then. And people have asked me about my shirts a lot. Actually, I've gotten quite a few comments and questions about them. So I looked and looked and looked, and it took me quite a while to find a platform that I could use to create my own shirts and offer them to you guys, and now I'm doing that. So the platform is Spreadshirt.com. And the link is in the notes section below. And there are also links on my website and also on my podcast website to the webpage that is my product page at Spreadshirt. So it is called Critical Merchandise. And this is the first sample that I got in the mail this week. This is my Got Logic shirt. And it's got my logo on the back. And I'm pretty happy about the whole thing. You can get the shirts in different colors. And there's also other products available besides shirts. There's a ridiculous number of products. I mean, hoodies and sweaters and women's shirts, men's shirts, kids' shirts, iPhone cases, like phone cases, mugs, you know, all, an apron, I think. All kinds of products that I created on this, specifically with this design. There are other designs I've made that you'll also see. In fact, here's a shot of the page. And when you click on the design, it'll show you what products I've produced and have been made available. If you have requests, just let me know, email me, leave it in the comments section. And I hope that this is something that you guys will go check out and look into. Because I've, like I said, I certainly got no shortage of requests about a lot of the shirts that I wear. So you'll be seeing more of these, and that's enough of that commercial break. So let's get on with your questions now. Yusuf. Hi, Chris. Love your channel. Question. I was involved in a Muslim cult when I was in college and university days. The cult was actually very similar to Scientology. I've never really fully recovered as such. I've encountered many problems in my life, but one problem really troubles me, dwelling on the past. I often in my mind obsessively debate scenarios from the past. I imagine myself yelling and refuting the cult I was with, embarrassing them the way they embarrassed me, making their leaders feel stupid, etc. All of these are scenarios I ruminate on. I often debate them on social media, and I get very obsessive on chasing and confronting them. This despite the fact that the cult has died down over the years and has few members left. Yet still, I rehash arguments and refutations against them in my mind, and the off chance I meet them on the streets and show them that I am now in the know and can take them on easily. Why am I like this? Is this something that ex-cult members face? Would you say that this is a form of OCD? Okay, well, I am certainly not qualified, and I'm not even going to attempt to give you some kind of a therapeutic diagnosis on YouTube. But I do have some comments about this that I hope will be of some help. I do, of course, understand the situation that you're in and we're, you know, in the headspace and I get it, you know, and it's rough. This is all the information I have and it's not enough really for me to give you really good advice, but here's some off the cuff stuff I can tell you. One, I would get off social media as far as chasing or pursuing these guys or trying to take them on or debate them. You're dealing with people who are in a cult mentality and they're programmed to not give you the satisfaction that you're looking for. I don't go to Scientology group Facebook pages or go to protests in front of churches of Scientology or go engage with Scientologists. And I don't do that because I know that that's not how I'm going to make a difference. And it's not how I think, I don't think it would be effective, right? Because you're just needling them and giving them a hard time. And that doesn't tend to give any degree of immediate satisfaction or return on investment, so to speak. That's why I don't do it. When I was in Scientology, if somebody was trying to debate me or give me a hard time or protest or something, they were going to lose every time. That was just how I thought. And I'm sure that, you know, in other destructive cults, such as the one you were in, it would be the same story. So I don't think one-on-one engagement like that from an ex-member is a good idea. I've mentioned before that I think protesting and things like that has a limited degree of workability to it, but one-on-one, forget it. Then you have to deal with what's in your head, the experiences that you had, and the anger and the resentment and the upset and all of that. And that's rough. All of us are individuals and we deal with it differently. So there's no broad answer for everybody. A suggestion is to that I've heard has worked for other people is to write a letter, you know, saying everything you'd want to say. Just get it all out of you, right? Just download. Everything, if you could talk to the cult leader or an average member and just get it all out of you, what would you say, right? That has had therapeutic results, I've heard in the past. That's all to do, but that's a thing that can kind of get some of that out, right? So it's not just playing in your head. There's some kind of value to typing it or writing it down. This is also why I've suggested in the past being an advocate against destructive cults or against that specific group, like what I do. It helps. It's catharsis. It's cathartic. The other thing, of course, is getting education on the subject. I have, from day one, preached that learning about destructive cults and how they operate, for me, gave me a lot of closure on the whole subject. Reading Steve Hassan, reading John Atack, reading Robert Lifton, reading Margaret Singer, right? Watching videos of theirs on YouTube where they discuss the techniques and methods and whatnot that are used, how they're used, how indoctrination occurs. That helped me a lot. And so I recommend it to other people, but it's just my suggestion. And finally, they're seeing a professional counselor, right? Which I really can't recommend enough. It's not something I've done personally, but of course I've interviewed Rachel Bernstein, for example. Joe Zimhart's not a therapist, but he's done cult exit work. I've interviewed them on my podcast and on my channel here. I'm good friends with other psychologists and therapists as well. And I've found that if you can't do it yourself, get some help. There's no shame. There's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely, positively no stigma should be attached to that at all. The real challenge with us ex-destructive cult members is finding a counselor or therapist who's going to know what they're talking about and what they're doing. And that's not always the easiest thing to find. I don't know where you live. I don't need to know. But look around and see in your area, maybe also consult resources, online resources. There's the ICSA, International Cultic Studies Association. They have a website. Maybe they have some resources. And there might be others, other resources to find. I haven't done a real thorough job of this, but I know that there are people out there who do understand undue influence, do understand destructive cults and how they operate, and can be of assistance of a counseling nature as a result. So those are my recommendations. I'm not a therapist. I'm not even pretending to be. It's just my advice from me, Chris Shelton, to you, and I hope some of that maybe helps. Rachel Stone. This is the first time that tuning in raised a few little defensive hairs on the back of my neck, so I thought I'd weigh in for a change. I care about the truth, but found myself emotionally put off by your guest, Aaron Raw, and I'm looking for an explanation as to why. By your own viewpoint, shouldn't people be open and accepting of differing religious, cultural, and scientific ideas and facts from a multitude of sources in their searches for that truth? I see my friends and family expressing and living a wide range of beliefs and lifestyles. Some make me cringe, but others make me wonder if there is something there because they seem to be thriving within their belief system slash religion. Perhaps man did invent God, but I question whether or not human beings have an emotional need to do so. As long as no one is being harmed in the process, as one might be in a destructive cult, yes, I get the huge gray area here. A little magical thinking might serve as a handy corral for positive social norms and serve as motivation to treat the other human beings on the planet with kindness, respect, and some form of a hopefully fair degree of justice. I understand that truly horrific things have also been and are being done in the name of God, any or all, and other faith-based beliefs. Personally, my husband and I just lost all four parents to cancer in a 2.5-year period. It comforts my grieving heart to think that they are not completely gone from existence, despite what my critical mind has come to believe. So, my questions are, do you believe that it's possible that, despite the apparent facts, we have a basic, possibly even biological need to believe in a higher power and to exercise the values that we attribute to that belief as a beneficial component of our culturally mosaic social order? Do you think that the stigma attached to atheism could have anything to do with the emotional pain associated with rationalizing with and attempting to convert the faithful to the belief that faith doesn't exist, which may in turn be viewed by them as threatening or as a stripping away of their security and culture? If someone seems happy in their chosen faith, is it the manifest destiny of atheists to witness, rationalize, to these potentially self-deluded people? In doing so, might some well-meaning atheist cause more emotional harm than intellectual good? Perhaps atheism wouldn't get such a bad rap, trust me, I live in Texas and it does, if it didn't seem as cold or threatening by providing alternative social structures that promote equality, honesty, compassion, and so forth. But aren't attempts to pull that kind of thing off inherently in danger of becoming the next versions of inevitably flawed systems of belief or religions? How would you resolve that paradox? First off, let me say my condolences for the loss of your parents and in-laws. That is definitely rough, and I'm sorry about that. As far as all of the questions you've basically asked every question that faces or plagues atheists and the trouble with that topic. It's a big subject, and there's a lot of professional atheists out there who are on YouTube or in other places, write books and whatnot, addressing these concerns, and they do a much better job than I could. I'll answer your questions, but I'm just letting you know that there's other resources out there by people who are way smarter than I am, who have done a lot of thinking on this and have come up with some pretty good answers for a lot of what you're asking about. But since you're asking me, I will tell you that, yes, I do believe that most religion is emotion-based. And when you threaten people's emotions and they're feeling good about something, they get pissed off and they think you're giving them hate speech and they think that you're against them personally as though, you know, they are their beliefs and this sort of thing. And it's such an emotionally charged subject that you cannot walk into it without stepping on landmines. It's impossible. It's just impossible. You can't have a rational discussion about the subject of religion with most believers. And I don't say that to belittle them. It's just a fact. So that's a problem with us, right? And it's not just a problem with religious believers. It's a problem with belief, period. Once we, as human beings, have accepted that something is true, despite no real evidence or even counter evidence to that belief, doesn't matter. We're not set up mentally to operate logically. We're not set up to operate on rational belief. We're set up we've evolved into operating emotionally. Emotion always, always, always trumps evidence, logic, and reason. So it's a battle. And it's a battle against what feels good or what gives you the feeling of comfort or reassurance or a belief that you will not end, that there will be more, versus the stark, honest, cold truth that there is zero evidence to back up any such belief. Is it inherently harmful to have such beliefs? It shouldn't be, yet look at what goes on in the world because of these beliefs. You tell me, right? What about radical Islam? What about radical Christianity? What about the Crusades? What about the Inquisition? So you have lots of historical reasons, genocides, really, that have been committed in the name of religion. So is the belief harmful? Well, not everybody who has the beliefs engages in violent extremism. Yet those who engage in violent extremism certainly use those beliefs as justification. So I've gone back and forth as to whether it's the belief that causes it or whether the person's just going to be violent anyway and just uses the belief as a justification for it. And I think there's probably, in the real world, you'll probably find instances of both. People do become radicalized. That is a stark truth. You take a normal person, regular guy, and you start convincing him down this line of undue influence, and you become and the person becomes radicalized, and then he's killing people because he believes that it's the holy thing to do and that God wants him to do that. So you go, yeah, there's a problem with that belief. Now, as I spoke with Aaron Ra about, not everybody who has religious beliefs does that by a long shot. Okay, good. So for the people like you who've asked me this question, Rachel, you know, what do I think of you? Well, I don't have a problem with you, of course, because you're not hurting anybody and you don't want to hurt anybody and you just have these beliefs that offer you comfort and that's nice. I think to address your point about, you know, do atheists feel that it's their manifest destiny to rationalize to these people? I think what you find in the atheist community is a protest against the violence and the bad things and the miseducation of their children at public schools using this religious beliefs, right? Try to, you know, in the South, not have the debate, right? I've seen video of school kids flat out trashing the facts of evolution because they go home and their Bible-thumping parents tell them that God created the world 6,000 years ago, which is complete horseshit, and that they don't need to read any of that scientific crap because it's all just a bunch of pagan atheist nonsense. Right? Well, that's just not true. That's a lie. And it's a destructive lie. Because if you start setting people up to not believe provable evidence and provable facts in favor of totally illogical, unproven, irrational beliefs, those kids are not doing that because it makes them feel good. They're doing it because it's what's being enforced on them. I can't protest that sort of thing enough. So if the parents want to believe it because it makes them feel good and that's their choice, they've actually made a rational decision to ignore evidence and believe what makes them feel good because that's how they choose to live their life, fine. But those kids aren't making that decision. Those kids aren't, that's not the choice they're being given. So I don't agree with that at all. I don't think we should be teaching religion to kids who have no judgment on the matter. I think that's crazy, and I have a little bit of experience with that. So I wasted a good part of my life because I was raised with these beliefs that I never even thought to question. Why would I? My parents were, you know, gods to me. My parents were the ones who told me how things are in the world. That's what parents are to their kids most of the time. So when the parents are saying this is how it is, there is all kinds of confirmation bias going into believing what the parents say and rejecting and discarding anything that's not in alignment with what the parents say. So I think that is inherently destructive, right? Because it sets up mental traps and problems for the kid where he's now not going to believe the facts that are right in front of his face, right? So that's a problem in critical thinking and logic and just an ability to teach this child to think. So those are the sort of things that go through my mind on this topic, right? So it might, you know, what helps me a lot in looking at this, because we, especially in the United States, are raised with this idea of sanctity and holiness and these beliefs, and we automatically grant, you know, ministers and priests and whatnot this exalted status, right? Because they're somehow better than we are. I've found one thing that helps my critical thinking with this is to think about not God or angels or devils or am I going to hell or stuff like this, but I changed the context to blue Smurfs. You know, do I believe in Smurfs? You know, no, of course I don't, right? Why? Because there's no evidence that they exist, right? So if I start assigning all the things that people assign to God to Smurfs, it quickly becomes apparent how ridiculous of a belief it is. And that is, you know, how I've made the comparisons in my own head. Because believe me, there's just as much evidence for Smurfs as there is for a Christian, you know, anthropomorphic deity who is definitely created by man. And it gives me no comfort, it gives me no joy to know that this is the way things are. It scares the hell out of me. It terrifies me. It makes me fear death. It makes me fear the unknown of death. And I still, you know, hold out hope that maybe some proof could be found. I have a very open mind, very open, believe me, to the idea of past lives and future lives and the idea that we don't just end when our bodies die. I would so much want for that to be true. So I'm wide open to proof, verifiable scientific evidence of such things. And if I can ever be presented with that, I'll take it and I will be the first to tell you folks about it. So, because I don't want to end, right? And I don't think anybody does. So those are some of my, you know, off-the-cuff thoughts about this. I'm not going to go on and on about it, but I hope that addresses some of your question. TJB fan, you seem to use the words psychology and psychiatry interchangeably, as if they mean exactly the same thing. I always thought that psychiatry was the more evil of the two, as that branch uses electroshock and the continuous drugging of patients and so forth, as described by Mark Rathbun about his brother in his memoirs book. Whereas psychology is more concerned with therapy and maybe some prescription antidepressants and such that you could take at home. Do you see any significant difference between the two in the way you discuss them? Oh yeah, no, these are hugely different things, and I don't use the terms interchangeably at all. Psychiatry, a psychiatrist is a medical doctor. He's gone to medical school. And then he did 4 more years of education in a psychiatric institution where they get all this formal education and training in being a psychiatrist, which is a treater of mental illnesses and mental diseases and pathologies. A psychologist is the study of the soul or mind, as what the words come back to. And a psychologist does not go to medical school. So your question is off. I don't think you really understand the differences yourself, because a psychiatrist is the only ones who can prescribe medications because they're medically trained doctors. A psychologist cannot prescribe medication. A psychologist can work in tandem with a psychiatrist and often does to have their patients or the people that they're counseling prescribed medications under the responsibility of the medical doctor or the psychiatrist. That's a huge difference between the two. And I don't consider either one of them evil. I have, I of course, you know, in the past, psychiatry was as barbaric as medicine in the past was barbaric. You know, we've learned a lot over the years, and psychiatry has advanced a lot since Hubbard's, you know, ranting and raving about it in 1950 with, you know, the men in the white coats who are going to electric shock you and lobotomize you and all that sort of thing. That sort of thing is not as popular and is not as done as much as it used to be. So that's just a fact. And I've even the guys who were doing that back then, I don't really think that all of them were, you know, Hitlerian doctors who were trying to, you know, carry out their evil experiments on unwitting patients. I think they were doing that because that was the state of the science at the time, and it wasn't a great state. There's a lot of problems I have with psychiatry now in terms of psychotropic medications and that sort of thing, not getting tested enough, not getting enough trials, that sort of thing. I got some problems with Big Pharma, yet I also know that there are people who are friends of mine, who are very close to me, who could not have the quality of life that they have if it wasn't for the psychotropic medications they were taking. So I'm not in a black and white state of thinking about this anymore like I used to be. So psychiatry is not all bad, psychology is not all good. It's not like that, right? There are good people, there are bad people, just like every other subject matter you'll find. And there's good methods and there's not so good methods. And not every method works universally on every person. Some people respond very well to psychotropics, for example, other people don't. And that's why I think more testing, more clinical trials, more research into this is definitely called for. But no, I don't use those terms interchangeably. I do understand that there's a difference between them. Gary Page. The International Justice Secretary, as the only terminal for declared SPs, must surely become PTS to any SP he deals with. How is this dilemma resolved by the C of S? That question was almost pure Scientology's, and if you guys understood it, you've been watching me too long. All right, so the question being asked, for those of you who don't understand all that garble, is there is a person, if somebody is declared a suppressive person in the Church of Scientology, there is only one person in the Church of Scientology that that SP, that suppressive person, can now interact with and have communications with. That person is called the International Justice Chief, not Secretary. And the International Justice Chief, or IJC, is the person who administers the approval of a suppressive person declares in Scientology and is the person who's supposed to see to it that if the guy wants to change and reform and get back in the church's good graces, that he follows a certain prescribed series of steps called A to E, A, B, C, D, E steps, which are done under his direction, and so the suppressive person still has a way of getting back into the church's good graces. If I wanted to, for example, as a declared suppressive, I could write a letter to the IJC, and I could plead, and you know, and eventually do those steps and get back in the church's good graces, which I will never, ever do. So the question is, if you're not supposed to be cavorting around with and connected to SPs when you're in Scientology, then how come IJC can do it? And wouldn't he go PTS or become a potential trouble source, right? PTS, that's the label that the Scientology gives you if you're connected to a suppressive person. You're supposed to disconnect from the suppressive person, not be connected to them. Yet IJC has to be connected to all these people. Well, it's nonsense because, of course, you're asking a good question there, and IJC should be in pretty bad shape cavorting with all of us horrible SPs. But IJC is also supposed to be totally trained up on all of the Hubbard advices and information and technology on how to deal with us SPs, so he should be able to confront and handle and shatter us, and so it shouldn't be a problem for him. And if you actually look up any pictures of who IJC is, Mike something or other, and look at what bad shape this guy is in, I'd say he is probably one of the most PTS people I've ever seen. Whoa, it's time for flash answers. Ara Magoo, would you agree that a study of destructive cults would be useful in understanding organizations which have some, but not all, characteristics of destructive cults? Yeah, of course, absolutely. That's what's helped me to be able to differentiate between what is and isn't a destructive cult. So, yeah. City Street 7. Hi, Chris. I know you used to work on the Ideal Org program, so you should definitely know what's going on. I recently saw an artist rendering of Miami's Ideal Org from Mike Render's blog, Thursday Funnies. And the building looks huge, with an apparent parking garage and everything. I've always heard most Scientologists in Florida are in Clearwater, though. Does Miami really need this massive building? Absolutely not. None of the Church of Scientologies need massive buildings. It's a real estate scam. That's what it is. This is so simple that it's really like, I'm kind of surprised that there's still questions about it, which is not to say don't ask me questions. It's just, you know, it's a scam. And that is what they're doing. And they're buying these big properties because they're worth a lot. And they're owned by the Church of Scientology International. So it's all about money, 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 and investing so that the IRS continues to give them their tax-exempt status, because the church is reinvesting its funds in itself and can show the IRS that it's doing this so that the IRS will back off and leave them alone. Junctioneer Blog. Is the top management of the cult not working to expand simply because with a huge influx of new members, there could be a demand for changes by the basic Scientologists? More members, more of a possibility of current leaders losing control and/or reform of the church. No, actually, it's a lot simpler than that. There is no effort by top management of the church to expand because none of the people who are supposedly there at top management are actually there doing any work. They are in the hole, or they are under, you know, subjugation by David Miscavige, and they're not doing management. So all the people who should be working to expand Scientology aren't even there, except in name only, if even that anymore. It's all David Miscavige, it's all his show. So that is Scientology, and you can see that Scientology is not expanding and isn't trying to expand because he doesn't care about it expanding. That's not his game, that's not what he's trying to do, it's not what he's ever been interested in, at least not for the last 20 years. And the guy is, you know, he's just on a power trip and he's got all the money and power that he could want in the world. And that's the game he's playing. So as long as he can have those things, why would he care about expanding Scientology? Okay, and so we've reached the end of another episode. I hope these answers were informative, useful, helpful in some way. You know, there's a lot that I could say about some of these things, but I am limited to a degree by the amount of time that I have here, and I don't want to bore people with too long of answers, which I know I do sometimes. When I get on a roll about stuff, and half the show ends up being one answer to one question, so I'm trying to minimize that. So I'm hoping I'm doing okay with this. You guys let me know. But again, check out the links to my product line. I'm very excited about these and very interested in your feedback on it. And as always, of course, thank you very much for coming around and watching. I really appreciate your viewership. And for those of you who are supporting me via Patreon or PayPal, love or whatever, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And I'll see you guys next week.